4's Antidote to Panel Games.
I'd like you please to suggest titles of bands likely to be playing at a pop festival for plumbers.
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are clogging.
With plenty more silly things to do for Milton Jones,
I predict a ride.
Joe Brand, ride. Andy Hamilton and Jan Ravens.
We've all enjoyed an aubergine blancmange.
I'm sorry, I haven't a clue.
Just checking, does everyone remember how to end the game?
Starting on Monday evening at 6:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Something to look forward to over the weekend. Now on Radio 4 with more uncompromising views, Alexei Sayle's imaginary sandwich bar opens for the final time this series.
There's a very 90s best-selling novel, acid pink cover and everything, published in 1996 called A White Merc with Fins, written by a guy called James Hawes. I read it when it came out, and at one point in A White Merc with Fins, the main character goes for a drink in a pub in central London. And in the pub, he sees the comedian, Alexei Sayle. The character goes up to Alexei Sayle and he says, I'm your biggest fan, Alexei. And Alexei Sayle says, that doesn't mean we have a relationship. This has the air of authenticity. I don't remember it happening precisely, but that kind of snotty remark sounds exactly like something 1990s Alexei Sayle would say. He was a bit of a bastard, 1990s Alexei Sayle. In his unstructured Armani suit and designer stubble, hanging out at the Zanzibar Club with TV chef Anthony Worrell Thompson. And the Backstreet Boys. Playing with his Tamagotchi. A little while later, I heard that they were making a movie of A White Merc with Fins. So I wrote to the producers and I said, while I am not the most versatile of actors, I feel the part of Alexei Sayle is one I could play with conviction. The producers finally wrote back and said 1990s Alexei Sayle had been written out of the script. We shouldn't judge him too harshly, though, 1990s Alexei Sayle. He was an angry and bitter man who was beginning to comprehend that audiences were slowly realizing that they could go for a nice night out to see a comedian, and it didn't necessarily need to involve being screamed at by a fat Marxist in a tight suit. Could come home feeling warm and reassured rather than upset and impotent. For a decade, he had bestrode the light entertainment landscape like a very colossus. Now he was being replaced by younger apolitical performers, rolling back his strict and inflexible rules on what you were or weren't allowed to laugh at. He was lost. In any entertainer's career, there are peaks and troughs. Sometimes you're in fashion, sometimes you are not. So in what I think of as my wilderness years, I turned my back on stand-up comedy for nearly two decades, and viewing myself as a serious author, instead became involved for a while, touring tiny arts venues in remote parts of the country. The first half of the 90-minute show I performed was a reading from my published short stories and novels, and the second half was me holding a question and answer session with the audience. The three weirdest questions I can remember being asked came one after the other in a tiny arts centre in Gloucester. They were, should ginger people be allowed jobs? Have you ever been in a mental institution and what was the food like? And have you ever thought of selling magazines from a handcart in the high street? Sometimes the questions could be good, though. I was launching my latest volume of memoir in 2016 at the Liverpool Philharmonic Hall, and in the Q&A, a bloke put his hand up, and I thought he was going to, like, ask me about, you know, the influence of Thomas Hardy on my prose style. But instead, he said, what's the latest you've ever stayed up? I was stumped for an answer, so I said to him, I don't know, what's the latest you've ever stayed up? And he said, Wednesday. varied the book reading show with appearances at literary festivals in small market towns, where I would be interviewed on stage about my career by an embittered local author. Who couldn't wait to ask me on stage, why did your publishers, Bloomsbury, reject my sex robot detective novel set in space? The tiny art centre circuit was a sad one. Retired cricketers talking about their recovery from alcoholism. Michael Portillo talking about where he buys his pink trousers. And disgraced former Emmerdale stars reading their slam poetry. At the venue, the sound technician would always ask what music you wanted played before the show. Understandably, most performers pick something jaunty to try and get the audience in a happy mood. But one night, for some reason, in a former corn exchange in Cirencester, or maybe it was an ex-bike shed in a village 6 miles outside Harrogate, I can't remember. I chose this. It's called Jesus Blood Never Failed Me. Originally appearing in 1971, it is a 74-minute long track by avant-garde musician Gavin Bryars, based on an endlessly repeated loop of an unknown homeless man singing a brief improvised stanza. The audience were forced to listen to about 25 minutes of this before I came on. I never got that audience back. That was the most miserable show I have ever done. But that track got me thinking about repetition. Repetition, which is often employed in our culture. Through something being repeated, you get to appreciate different facets of that thing, aspects that weren't apparent the first time around, attributes that weren't visible on the first encounter. Monet did 250 paintings of the same water lilies in his pond. In the cabaret Voltaire, the birthplace of Dadaism, performers would repeatedly tell the same joke simultaneously in a variety of different languages. And Boris Johnson told the same lie over and over again. Get Brexit done, oven-ready deal, levelling up, and I'm not a compulsive shagger with a drug problem. Oh, here we are at my imaginary sandwich bar. Yay!
Behold my sandwich bar. Peps at bargain prices, where all you cheats and thieves and liars come for rolls and custard slices. 'Cause humanity is cant and vanity, but underneath it all, a man's a man which does enjoy his daily sandwich.
Hello everybody, I'm Alexis Allen, welcome to my imaginary sandwich bar. Over here is the pretend counter, behind me is the illusory coffee machine, and in front of me the non-existent customers. Here's one of them now. Hello mate, what can I do for you?
Hello Alexis! Nice sandwich bar you've got here.
Well, thank you.
Be ashamed if anything happened to it.
Hey, how do you mean?
I mean, there could be a fire or problems with the broadband or the windows could get broken. But if you paid a small fee, we'd make sure that sort of thing didn't happen.
I see. What sort of fee?
2 corned beef and tomato babs every Tuesday and a packet of Doritos and a Diet Coke.
Yeah, all right, there you go.
Cheers, Alexi! See you next Tuesday! Stay safe!
That was playwright and memoirist Alan Bennett. So to return to the idea of repetition, Keir Starmer may be doing better in the polls right now, but I am reminded of how in 19th century Spain, they had this thing with their governments called El Turno, the turn. There were 2 identical parties. There was the Conservative Democratic Liberals and the Liberal Conservative Democrats. And they just used to take turns ruling Spain. One party would govern for a bit, loot the country, ensure the wealthy stayed wealthy, and then hand over to the other party who'd do the same. So I'd like you to note the use of repetition in this piece of slam poetry, which I'll be touring around half-full art centres in the spring, entitled I Hate Keir Starmer. hate Keir Starmer. I hate him aesthetically. I hate his fussy little, too perfect, just shy of Nazi officer haircut. I hate his Prime Minister from Central casting face, which initially seemed designed by committee, but increasingly suffers from having an expression slapped on it like he's desperately trying to explain away his role in a sex scandal at the dog pound he runs. His pedantic voice, which makes everything he says sound like an HR meeting you didn't really need to be at. Starmer is a small man, physically short, yes, but that's not really notable, except as a symbol of the immense spiritual shortness that it signifies. He is aesthetically petty and dull, a piece of hotel art made man. I hate Keir Starmer. I hate him ethically. I hate the way that Starmer poses as an honest man, then casually breaks every pledge he made to the Labour membership before they elected him as leader. I hate that he's a liar and he's not even good at it. Plainly, what he is good at is being a coward. I hate Keir Starmer because what we all need is the possibility of actually doing something, concrete action that might actually make the world a better place, and Keir Starmer is a fat bag blocking this possibility. I hate Keir Starmer like a malfunctioning bus stop sign that keeps telling me my bus is about to show up, but it never does. I hate Keir Starmer because he has been imposed on me, whether I like it or not, and he will not go away. The only time he looked like winning an election was when he was up against Liz Truss. A blustering idiot who seems to have gotten lost on the way to filming a series of The Apprentice. He ended up being appointed Prime Minister. Even if Starmer was replaced, one suspects his wing of the Labour Party would conspire to put Shadow Health Secretary Wes Streeting in charge instead. Someone who looks like Starmer's son, who he made out of margarine. I hate Keir Starmer. But I don't want to hate Keir Starmer. What I want, what we need, is a world in which nobody hates him, because nobody has to think about him at all. You know, it's been really hard getting this series written, and comedians are forced into various strategies to generate new material. Some turn up unannounced at comedy clubs with half an idea, which by the time they get on live from the Apollo is three quarters of an idea. Others do work-in-progress shows, while old-school comics like Ken Dodd would simply buy jokes from gag writers. When Ken Dodd died, we all moved up one. And so now, as the oldest working Scouse comedian, I am in charge. Southport's Lee Mack, St. Helens' Johnny Vegas all have to bow down before me. Bishop has to go and get my dry cleaning. Ken Dodd was accused of tax evasion. His response was, "They call it the Inland Revenue, but I live by the sea." See, I'm getting laughs off your material, Doddy. You buck-toothed old Tory. That's another way to get stand-up material. The hunt for new material can lead you to some pretty dark places. Many years ago, at the start of my career, I turned up at the Original Comedy Store one night with this new piece of comedy I'd come up with, which was a quiz where if the audience didn't get the questions right, I pointed a gun at them and threatened to shoot them. I'd bought the gun from Linda's Littlewood's catalogue. If you don't remember, Littlewood's catalogue was like the Amazon website, but made out of dead trees. The gun was actually an air pistol, but in appearance it was a pretty convincing imitation of a model 1911 Colt 45 caliber military sidearm. Now, here's a tip for up-and-coming young comics. Don't point a gun at the audience. It makes them nervous. At first, the audience at the Comedy Store were just indifferent to my opener, but when I started screaming and pointing a very real-looking gun at them, they became extremely agitated and understandably started yelling for me to get off. The MC let me carry on, but despite that, I died a terrible death. After I came off stage, I also learned that there was a journalist in the crowd from the Observer newspaper who's doing the first big feature ever on the Comedy Store in a national newspaper. And just to make things worse, for me, this was the first night that Rick Mail and Adrian Edmondson appeared. In my unhappiness, I regarded the student pair with contempt and desperately wished for them to fail. Yet once they began to perform, my pain got even deeper because they were fantastic, with a crazy energy that made them the undoubted hit of the night, especially compared with the sweaty, unfunny guy with the gun who'd been on before. It made my failure all the more painful. I wobbled back to our council flat on my bike, and when I got home, I fell into deep despair, thinking that my career was ruined almost before it had begun. It turned out, though, that it wasn't my fault. It was the guns. Maybe because it had developed a small fault and I'd refused to pay Littlewoods the balance of what was owed on it, the gun may have collected some bad karma. Once I got to know them better, I lent the gun to Rick and Aid for a sketch they wanted to do with them as terrorists holding the entire audience hostage. And like my quiz bit, that sketch went down really badly. Then later on, the gun was stolen from the horrible council flat in Kennington, which they shared, and was subsequently used to hold up a post office. The robber of the post office was shot and wounded by armed police. So it was a very unlucky gun. You didn't need much new material if you were emceeing rock festivals. You just used what was happening around you. I emceed the Pyramid Stage at Glastonbury 4 times in the 80s. For instance, on the second occasion in 1985, a famously muddy year, I announced from the stage, "Somebody's lost a contact lens." If you could all just have a look for it. For my third appearance, I drove down to Worthy Farm with Linda in my jet black 1970 Rover 3.5-litre P5B coupe. One of the questions philosophy asks is, can a person truly lie to themselves? By owning a 15-year-old classic car, I think I managed to do just that. Everybody thought from what I told them that by possessing this sleek, powerful, chromed, rare, historic machine, I was making myself truly happy. Whereas, in fact, every day, minute and second it was in my possession, that car made me utterly and profoundly miserable because it kept breaking down. The RAC man would say when I called him out, "Oh, great cars these, really reliable." And I'd think, if it's so bleeding reliable, how come I know the names of all your grandchildren? And you're thinking of going to Portugal for your holidays this year. So as we pulled into a service station on the M4, the Rover developed a brand new fault. The pressure gauge dropped like a stone, and I found if the speed dropped below 16 miles an hour, the engine would just die. After about 20 minutes, the car started again. But arriving at the vehicle entrance to the main stage at Glastonbury, it conked out once more, and I only got through the gates propelled by a number of emaciated Hawkwind fans. This time, it wouldn't fire up again for nearly 40 minutes, so I spent the whole day worrying about how I was going to get home. Finally, about 8, after introducing the last act, Elvis Costello playing solo, and as the prescient first bars of "Accidents Will Happen" echoed behind me, I called for the gates to be swung open, and engine revving, I headed for the road back to London. When I had driven into the backstage area on that sunny morning, there had been a rough track which led to the lane that took you out of Worthy Farm. But as the day had worn on, many festival goers had now erected tents, food stalls, children's playgrounds, yurts and teepees across it. With headlights on high beam and my foot pressed to the floor, I was forced to swerve from side to side, trying not to let the speed drop. What the crowd saw was Alexei Sale, the people's comedian, hurtling over the sacred fields of Glastonbury in a huge black car, horn blaring, massive VH engine screaming. Many did not realise what was happening at first. "Hey, Alexei, man," they would call out. "I'm a really big fan of yuck." Then there'd be a thump as the coupe sideswiped them. Can't let the speed drop. Problems with engine pressure, I would shout back. But pretty soon, an angry mob brandishing burning torches was pursuing my car, and it became even more vital that I didn't stop, as I now risk being torn apart by furious vegans. Finally, we reached the lane, and performing a handbrake turn, I managed to take the corner, and we headed back to London with no further trouble, except that I was picking scraps of denim and cheesecloth out of the Rover's radiator for days to come. Aging can be a real barrier to coming up with new material, because it's really important not to get set in your ways. When I was 60, I got my old person's free bus pass, and I took to riding the bus, something I hadn't done for years. One difference is now they've got that screen with the pictures from all the different CCTV cameras at the front, which is like a really boring in-flight movie. Though I find it often features a fat, baldy guy. And I really like his performance. Another thing that is different on the bus these days is all the people talking on their phones using earbuds. And because you can't see the earbuds, it just looks like they're sitting by themselves shouting. Now, in the 1960s and 1970s, when I used to ride the bus, somebody sitting alone shouting meant they were really frightening and potentially dangerous. I wonder if all those old school bus shouters are completely pissed off and they're going like, oh, the business has completely changed, man. I mean, back in the day, if you wanted to shout on the bus, you really needed to commit, man, you know. Completely come off your meds or drink 5 litres of vodka. When you're 60, you also get this request from the NHS asking you to send them a sample of your poo through the post. But they only give you this little spatula. That seemed ungenerous. So I sent them about £3. What I couldn't understand was why the return address was Jacob Rees-Mogg's house. I've just opened a packet of ibuprofen, or as the government would call it, a new hospital. I'm 70 now, and it's important at my age to try and stay healthy and to try and stay fit. I mean, I can still fit into the same trousers as I wore at college. Admittedly, I was attending clown school at the time. But sometimes you can't always avoid illness. In December 2015, one evening, I was reading an interview in a magazine with the Game of Thrones actor Charles Dance when I suddenly began projectile vomiting. Fair enough, you might think. But it didn't get better, and suddenly the whole side of my face fell and my eyesight deteriorated drastically. So eventually we called an ambulance and I was taken to hospital. Unfortunately, this happened on Black Eye Friday, the day in December when most companies hold their annual office Christmas fight. A time when hospital casualty departments are likely to be at their busiest for the year. Nevertheless, I was rushed into triage because the paramedics thought I might have had a stroke. Now, a friend of mine who was in his mid-60s told me that if you're taken into hospital, then it's important that you tell them that you've got a job, that you're still in work, that you're not just some old retired codger, because if they think that you are, they'll be cruel to you. They don't mean to be cruel, but you'll just get ignored. You'll be left on a trolley like a Black Forest gatto. So as these two young doctors were examining me, I said to them, I was in Holby City recently. Which was true, I was in Holby City playing a failed comedian. I don't know why. An actor friend of mine who was in Holby City for a couple of years and grew quite bitter about it said that every episode of Holby would be just 2 minutes long if all the patients said to the doctors, mind your own sodding business. Anyway, I said to these two young doctors that I'd been in Holby City, and I said, I had situs invertus. This is a condition where all the organs are on the wrong side of your body. Now, it turns out that young doctors do not watch soaps set in hospitals. And they thought it was a real place. And they both went white And one said to the other, how the hell did we miss that? Later on, another doctor was testing me for mental acuity, and they ask you a list of questions. What day is it? Where do you live? That sort of thing. And remember, this is 2015, and so he asked me, who's the Prime Minister? And I replied, that bastard Cameron. And Linda shouted, Lexi! Because it turns out that disinhibition, shouting out swear words, is an early sign of Alzheimer's disease. But this doctor was more switched on, and he said, no, in fact, that's his correct title. In the end, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition called neurosarcoidosis. Once something like this happens, others are eager to relate stories of similar events from their own lives. Everybody seems to know somebody, a friend or a relative, who has suffered some kind of brain disorder, the exact cause of which remains a mystery. Afterwards, a lot of these people, my friends tell me, have experienced deep feelings of serenity, a renewed sense of purpose, coupled with a resolve to live every day to its fullest, to wring every last drop of enjoyment from life. That hasn't happened to me yet. Then, in 2018, I started peeing blood. And again, I went to hospital. And at the hospital, I had a cystoscopy. That's where they stick a camera up your penis. That wasn't too bad. It was the lighting crew. Because the broadcast unions are still very powerful. Anyway, afterwards, the doctor came to me and he said, you've got bladder cancer. And I thought, So, 6 weeks later, I had an operation, and that night, the surgeon came to me and he said, you don't have bladder cancer. In fact, you never had cancer. There was nothing there, but that's good, isn't it? Nobody's ever been annoyed to be told they don't have cancer. And I said, well... You see, there's been this trend in comedy over the last 10 years or so where you take something terrible that's happened to you, sexual assault, illness, depression, death of a parent, diagnosis of ADHD, and you do a show about it. People say, we went to see this comic at the weekend and she did a show that was so disturbing, we wanted to tear the flesh off our faces. Now, I don't want to come over all Bob Monkhouse on your ass. But that's not stand-up comedy! Nevertheless, in the time between being told that I had cancer and being told that I didn't have cancer, I'd written this show. I was going to take up to Edinburgh, entitled, Look at Me, I've Got Cancer! And I was expecting all these five-star reviews, you know. Oh, I always thought he was crap, but now he's got cancer, I think he's great. You may or may not have been listening to Alexi Sells' Imaginary Sandwich Bar. Thank you, good night. Alexi Sells' Imaginary Sandwich Bar.